Well, good morning on this frigid Oregon morning. My name is Michael McCusker, and I am quite pleased and surprised I did not break my neck on the ice walking down the hill from my neighborhood, which I sort of call Astoria's Arctic Circle. Well, I wish to dedicate this program today to Thea Lania Pyle, to Nelson Mandela, and to Eleanor Roosevelt, and all others who conceived and wrote the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights 65 years ago, this past December 10th, being the anniversary. And Carol Newman did a beautiful job of it on Tuesday that day on her program, which I knew she would. I was going to read them today, but I thought, nah, she's probably going to do it. And she did. And it was a very good program. She both divided it up between Mandela and the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which I believe ought to be adopted into law everywhere in the world where human beings habit. Well, another anniversary is coming up. It's coming up on... I was just given a correction of my pronunciation of Tia's name. Gomen Asai. It is Tia, silent H. I last saw her maybe about a month ago, just before she went into the hospital. I'm very glad I did have a chance to talk with her. And I saw Bob when she was in the hospital, and we talked a bit about it just before her death. And all my sympathies and respect go to Robert Michael Pyle, one of the best people I know. Well, this coming Tuesday, December 17th, is the 110th anniversary of Powered Flight. So I would like to read something I've written and perhaps and rewritten and revised, and perhaps you might have heard once or twice on this program. 30 Seconds Over Armageddon. So I have to give the disclaimer, and I should probably do it for the remainder of this program because of all of this is just going to be stuff I scribbled down over periods about different subjects. That this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the cosmos and universes and parallel universes. 30 Seconds Over Armageddon, a quote by Mark Twain. We shan't leave our fortress now when we want to blow up civilization. And I.A.R. Wiley. Planes were invented by the Wright brothers some years ago, and when not engaged in killing people, or want to take them from one place to another. Without the presence of insects or birds, humanity might not have thought of flying through the air, though perhaps even without these, the simple act of falling to the ground could well have been inspiration for flight. The first attempts to swim through the sky imitated birds. Blotchy old films of some of these tries, men jumping from cliffs, flapping artificial wings attached to their arms or backs, strange homemade contraptions that usually crashed, seem funny now, but recorded real tragedy in visually eloquent pain, sometimes death, and failed or misapplied concepts of aerodynamics. By the time Wilbur and Orville Wright successfully flew the first engine-powered airplane 110 years ago this month, the striving to attain free flight above the Earth had developed balloons and gliders. Practical gas engines designed by Benz and Daimler provided the motive breakthrough. At Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 17, 1903, the Wright brothers flew the world's first true airplane, which they named simply Flyer. Orville Wright piloted the motorized glider a few feet over sand dunes on a windswept beach and raised human beings on wings of their own. Those wings have developed more rapidly in the past century and 10 years than any other human invention. Supersonic jets, space rockets, and intercontinental nuclear missiles are far removed from the generation of flying machines spawned by the Wright brothers' success. Within only a few years, warplanes were hurtling into the skies. Be 100 years next year. Powered flight developed in many directions, but it has been as an agent of warfare that has made the past century the bloodiest battleground in history. The bomber in particular has accounted for the slaughter of more victims than 100-fold of previous eras. Francesco Lana di Terzi wrote in 1670 his visions of fleets of aerial machines that could fly over cities and drop vast numbers of missiles down upon defenseless citizens below. On October 23, 1911, the first bombs were dropped from such machines over Tripoli during the Italo-Turkish War. The Turks protested the war crime of a hospital bombed. Aerial bombardment developed in World War I from reconnaissance flying. If an enemy could be seen, he might as well be bombed. Strategic bombing, or the psychological destruction of civilian fortitude, came afterward, first with the great German Zeppelin raids on London. For most of the war, World War I, the belligerents concentrated primarily on tactical bombing, which meant of each other's soldiers. The first long-range heavy bomber raids were made by the French in 1915 against German cities. Later that year, London suffered its first Zeppelin raids, which were followed by attacks by large bomber formations when Britain's air defenses outmatched the huge dirigibles. In turn, British bombers retaliated against Germany. The Italians made the only truly strategic raids during World War I, massing large numbers of aircraft to attack a single target, such as the Austro-Hungarian city Apola on October 22, 1918, the last major air raid of the war. The other warring nations haphazardly bombed each other for revenge and to raise morale in their respective homelands. World War I bombers were crude and clumsy, unable to haul big enough bomb loads for real damage. Yet they killed thousands of soldiers and civilians, and more significant to the human psyche, made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to existence. War movies and television documentaries have made World War II the sine qua non of air warfare. Photographs and films of huge formations of bombers flying through anti-aircraft bursts and whirling enemy fighters to drop tons upon tons of explosives on heavily populated cities. Der Terzi's vision fulfilled. Europe pounded to rubble. Japan set on fire and nuked by American B-29s. The pre-World War II terror bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War prompted Picasso's masterpiece, which portrayed the outcry of ordinary citizens against deliberate and indiscriminate death from the sky. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II were carried by large human-guided machines. More than half a century later, humanity has transferred its awesome arsenal of aerial devastation to primarily technological control, maintaining only a slippery hold on the trigger. The two world wars left much of the world in ruins, great cities bombed to rubble. European hegemony passed to two rival superpowers that had been allies and victors against Nazism, the United States, and Communist Russia. The result was a half-century Cold War and a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, a balance of terror defended by arguments that only nuclear parity would prevent a Third World War. The U.S. and the USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each government posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. Each claimed to be defending itself against the other, and the contradictory idea of a preventive war, starting a war to prevent a war, was a common rationale for threatening world obliteration. The two superpowers derived their power from increasing their arsenals and making treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons. At the same time that the U.S. and USSR were racing through generations of nuclear weapons, both built up their conventional forces and imported weapons, troops, and military aircraft to small wars that erupted all over the globe. Each war was a threat of nuclear confrontation, yet simultaneously these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure releases against the big blow. From a supposedly inviolable hemispheric fortress surrounded by oceans, the United States exported a highly sophisticated form of terror during the Cold War and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, attacking countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles, and most recently with drones. It pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere and used bombs more than any other nation, especially on cities and small villages of other nations. With few exceptions, the USSR in Afghanistan, Israel in its wars, the United States has been the major user of bombs since World War II, which includes nuclear tests. North Korea was blasted and hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers napalmed during 1950 to 1953. More than twice the amount of bombs dropped over Europe during World War II were used on California-sized Vietnam in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Civilians in the North made their lives underground underneath incessant American bombing. North Vietnamese city dwellers, like Londoners a quarter century before, evacuated their children to rural areas. After the first Persian Gulf War, the U.S. put an iron umbrella over the Middle East to guard its oil lines, striking with aircraft and missiles at targets in countries that disputed its virtual monopoly over their most lucrative regional product. The most startling use of terror from the air in the 21st century so far has been the attack on the USA by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles out of hijacked American airliners in a brilliant scheme of calculated destruction aimed at the empirical cathedrals of American civilization, the World Trade Center in New York, and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001. The attack was the worst death toll on a single day in American history, killing more than 2,000 persons. Retaliation from the air was quick and devastating. The contradictory attitude toward the so-called war on terrorism might be illustrated by rephrasing a famous remark by Winston Churchill during World War II. "Curse those bastards who crash airplanes into our cities, and bless our heroes who bomb their cities." Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate that war was so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He had not foreseen its possibilities as video entertainment, such as the two Persian Gulf Wars, provided with wire-guided missiles breaking down doors or falling through factory chimneys. A few cynics predict that future wars will be instigated against poor Southern Hemisphere countries to keep audience ratings high, a video Orwellian scenario of perpetual war using high-tech air war stuff against everything above ground. The use of missiles and bombs to kill Iraqi soldiers during the first Gulf War in 1991, in particular the Turkey shoot at Iraqis fleeing from Kuwait in a massive fleet of cars, trucks, tanks, evolved directly from the British use of fighters and bombers to wipe out two trapped Turkish divisions in 1918. The Israelis did the same thing when they caught a large column of Egyptian armor and soldiers in a narrow pass during the 1967 Seven Days War. The World War II equivalents might be the destruction of Nazi tanks and troops in the killing grounds of the so-called Falaise Pocket in 1944, and aerial attacks by U.S. naval aircraft on convoys of Japanese troop ships. Of the 50 or more million human beings who died in the Second World War, a considerable proportion died in bombing attacks. Life underneath the bombs has never been pleasant. Warning of imminent bombing attacks during World War II were signaled by horrendous sirens that many who experienced their sound say it chills their blood even now. Anything constructed underground was used for shelter by urban populations. Bomb shelters, prototypes of later backyard protections against nuclear attack, fortunately never tested, cluttered rural landscapes. The sirens were followed by the deafening drone of aircraft engines and firing of clustered anti-aircraft batteries, then the impact and explosions of thousands of bombs. Anyone above ground during the raids would see towering columns of smoke during the days, the glare of firestorms and searchlights at night. Hundreds of thousands were cremated or suffocated in their shelters. Untold numbers of families disappeared from history. On March 9, 1945, more than 300 B-29 Superfortresses attacked Tokyo. Max Boot wrote in his book, The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. Their napalm and magnesium incendiaries turned 16 densely packed square miles into an inferno. An estimated 84,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed, making this one of the deadliest days of warfare ever. Air Force General Ira Eaker complained in a foreword to a book about the bombing of Dresden, written by David Irving, yes, the same Irving, who denies the Holocaust, that the men who died in shot-down bombers are seldom considered in post-war books about the air war over Europe and Asia, though television documentaries are redundant in their portrayals of pilots and bomber crews. Most books concentrate on the massive death and destruction bombing raids caused, which is in contrast to books written during the war that justified bombing of civilian populations. Total warfare, after all, insists that all members of society either soldier or arm him. Tactical bombing seeks to destroy the soldier. Strategic bombing is more complex. Obliteration of production and supply is less a goal than erosion of morale, although several surveys indicate that bombing of civilians only increases their stoicism and antipathy toward their attackers, the anonymous flyers who indiscriminately murder friends, lovers, and children from the stratosphere. A U.S. bombing appraisal committee, which included John Kenneth Galbraith, concluded after World War II that bombing alone would never have sufficiently eroded determined resistance against attack by average German civilians. Galbraith personally thought, as survivors in Germany of Allied air raids attested, that bombing actually developed a camaraderie among those bombed on either side of the war. The immense air war of World War II can be scaled down to the minuscule. A family cowering in a shelter under a city ravaged by bombs, dropped from fleets of airplanes piloted by determined, frightened crews fighting off winged defenders whose rage and terror matched their enemy everywhere in the sky and on the ground, death and burning desolation. Only the Nazi death camps exceeded the horror of living underneath the bombs. The Germans initiated the slaughter with terror bombings of Guernica and Rotterdam and by their aerial war against England. A firestorm caused by incendiary bombs dropped by British aircraft on Hamburg in 1943 killed an estimated 100,000. The beautiful German city of Dresden was unnecessarily destroyed by bombers in 2 days and nights. Firebombing of Japan in 1945 incinerated several hundred thousand each raid on its cities by American B-29s. Atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki altered humanity's history and psyche. Michael S. Sherry wrote in his book, The Rise of American Air Power, The Creation of Armageddon, that the tension between large hopes and dark fears about the warplane said less about technology or erroneous predictions of air warfare than it did the cultures which would build and use bombers. Although these apocalyptic apprehensions and dreams of deliverance did not always explain why nations bombed one another, they at least suggest, Sherry wrote, how they would justify bombing or why they sometimes needed little justification at all. The development of the bomber has resulted in the slaughter of millions who might not have died in warfare without its use. Sherry wrote, to treat bombing simply as an abstraction, as a strategy or horrible fantasy or set of statistics, would be to repeat a persistent error in a half-century's preoccupation with the bomber, the tendency to regard it, and finally the atomic bomb, as more potent in imagination than in its capacity to kill and destroy. Perhaps the most inaccurate prediction about the age of the airplane was, as Sven Lindqvist wrote in A History of Bombing, the belief that, quote, flight would do away with the very cause of national conflicts by bringing people closer to one another. Those who have been divisive and hostile on the ground would live peacefully together in the boundless heavens during the age of flight. And that was Sven Lindqvist. And that was something I wrote 30 seconds over Armageddon. And now I'd like to read something that also that I wrote, so the disclaimer still holds. Apartheid means slavery. Now, we've heard a great deal about Mandela and what a great human being he was, but we really haven't concentrated on the terrible conditions in which he fought against. And I'll start with a quote by The Progressive in 1985. The South African government is an insult to humanity and deserves the contempt of all civilized beings. And Martin Luther King Jr., we must all live together as brothers or perish together as fools. The irresistible press of history extinguished the apartheid government of white South Africa, which spent most of the 20th century resisting it with a system of slavery that, with brief but periodic exceptions, became repulsive to civilization in the 19th century. White South Africa had imposed itself too long on the world and on its captive people, and finally history finished it off, although the trauma apartheid inflicted will persist for quite some time. White South Africa was itself an anachronism, a lost colony left behind and isolated by the crumbling empires of Europe. It was a final vestige of a colonial system that began 5 centuries ago, when Europe started its surge across the planet. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for European colonies in the Western Hemisphere, and most of Africa itself was colonized by European nations. For centuries, Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. The 2 great wars of the 20th century devastated European power and broke up its empires into independent states, most of which reverted to some form of home rule. The African colonies collapsed in the same manner until, almost alone on the continent and in the world, the white-dominated government of South Africa remained. From the start, the draconian concept of apartheid, which means separation, was white South Africa's defense against cultural extinction, a final entrenchment by an embattled political system struggling to survive a while longer. The entire brutal state apparatus that was designed to deny any political identity or power to the black majority, 70% of the population, could only be a stall against the inevitable tide of their disquiet, and served as a final laceration that ensured their rise to crush it. The systematic arrests and murders of emerging black leaders spawned the appearance of others, the detention, torture, and killing of children to stifle newer generations of insurgents only guaranteed their growth. Each step to maintain the regime was a greater atrocity that created a proportionate response. By the time reforms were offered to appease revolt, they were long past the needs or desires of those in revolt, and most of the time too late to stop them. Once the insurgents' power was recognized by acts of reform, they were too powerful to resist. All of the terrible, crippling pain, fear, and hatred that had been stifled and stored up for so long seemed perpetually prone to explode into rage, and the death dance between oppressor and oppressed speeded up, ruthlessness and reaction evolving inexorably toward denouement. Survival was the major object of apartheid, and the question why white South Africa would want to survive was as irrelevant as why any organism should wish to endure. White South Africa could not afford to compromise, or its visceral history would be lost. Its white culture, however much it repulsed most of the rest of the world, deceived itself that it was vital and historically legitimate. That its memory would undoubtedly be a legacy of intolerance and contempt was not necessarily apparent to itself. Nations, like persons, are not greatly noted for honest self-appraisal. The real fear was that after white rule was dismantled, genocide would be enacted against whites. There was also apprehension that the antipathy that had developed between the black factions and between them and blacks who worked for whites might erupt into a civil war or an immense pogrom. A native tyranny as harsh and ruthless as white rule was a great anxiety as well. History was a disquieting precedent. Slow, painful evolution toward political freedom was the hope, but the tendency of regimes released from foreign domination has usually been in the opposite direction. The people of Africa have not fared especially well under the home rules that replaced European dominance, but the possibility of positive change is at least within their borders. In the end, the response of most of the world to the white South African apartheid government was critical and supportive of the revolt of the black masses. But that had been a long time coming. The U.S. government had conducted itself shamefully during the Cold War years, and so also had the Soviet Union up until its own dissolution. Each in its own manner subverted or openly enforced its will upon vast populations throughout the world, and each engaged in the subversion of weaker governments. Each condemned the deplorable regimes in alliance with the other and defended the same ruthlessness of its own allies. As in most civil wars that occurred since World War II, the struggle in South Africa was a miniature Cold War. For a long time rejected by the United States, South Africa's black liberation movement turned to the Soviet Union for weapons and equipment. The U.S. failed to realize that by siding with oppressive regimes, it pushed the oppressed into the arms of the USSR. When Moscow helped the insurgents, the U.S. claimed Soviet aid as an excuse to overtly or clandestinely furnish armaments to the ruling status quo to destroy the revolt while exaggerating its threat to U.S. interests. This is what occurred in South Africa for almost half a century. And as it is with all such superpower disputes during the Cold War, the escalating trouble in South Africa threatened to be an incipient cause of nuclear war. The way it ended was that the white regime in South Africa disappeared as a final European enclave in the Third World. Sanctions were imposed, trade halted, investments withdrawn, loans canceled, ambassadors recalled, and relations severed. Finally, the white regime was forced to surrender its rule. Apartheid departed history with a whimper rather than a bang. Nelson Mandela died Thursday, 5 December 2013, at the age of 95. He spent nearly 30 years in a South African labor camp for attempting to eradicate apartheid and became Black Liberation's de facto leader and international symbol. He used his refusal of arrest from prison to wrest concessions from the white Afrikaner government. He was released in 1990. 4 years later, he became South Africa's first black president. In the course of his life, he was perhaps the most honored human in the world of his time in history. And now I'd like to read something. Today, it is 13 years since the U.S. Supreme Court selected George W. Bush as president of the USA by a vote of 5-4. I'd like to see read now something, Greens and Other Lepers, that I wrote. Think globally, act locally, a quote by René Dubois. Many friends told me months before the presidential election of 2000 that if I were to vote for Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke on the Green Party ticket, they would hold me personally responsible if Republican George W. Bush Jr. was elected instead of Democrat and Clinton heir Albert Gore. I argued that the two-party system does not represent the incredible variety and tenor of American politics, and that especially in recent years, as population and cultural diversity have multiplied immensely, the two parties seem to be merging into a single mega-party dominated by a country club apartheid of wealth, property, and multinational corporations. A new party is necessary to represent the unrepresented majority that does not possess equivalent wealth, property, or power, and also to reflect gender and racial equity. Several new parties. My choice of the Green Party was that it is an international party active in 80 countries, and its origins and organization are grassroots. We must have an international party if we are to have a global economy dominated by amalgamated mega corporations, which are fundamentally interlocking commercial empires that command vast wealth, capacity, and political influence. Parochial politics are inadequate to the global power structure that are forming beyond the shores of the USA, yet are dominated by its economic and military power. In a world community, political parties, as well as labor unions, medical, health, and environmental organizations, must think and act globally, and the Green Party offers the best opportunity for the globalization of political power, in particular for the representation of the immense and rapidly expanding global underclass. The paradox is that the USA simultaneously acts worldwide as the new Rome, intruding incessantly into global political and economic affairs, while rejecting global influence in its own internal affairs. One opinion, originating in Europe but perhaps held all over the world, is that American presidential elections in particular should be a worldwide suffrage. As Election Day 2000 neared and the presidential race rapidly narrowed, the Green Party became a focus of both major party campaigns, the Republicans encouraging votes for Ralph Nader in hopes of taking away votes from Al Gore, and the Democrats insisting that every vote for Nader was a vote for George Bush. Now is not the time for a third party, my liberal leftist friends insisted, the specter of a Bush victory too threatening to contemplate. All the hard-won victories of racial and gender equity, abortion rights, environmental protection, paltry as they are, undone. I wonder how our Greens will treat us for keeping faith when Bush squeaked into the presidency. See, perhaps the USA's first truly non-elected president, except for Gerald Ford, appointed to pardon Nixon, both also Republicans. They were right that most Nader votes siphoned votes from Gore and other Democrats, although many Greens voted only because of the third-party options. Are Greens going to be isolated as lepers, historically, or furiously purged like medieval Jews held responsible for the plagues rather than rats and fleas? And how will we leftist liberals react to the Bush presidency? Are we going to shirk back out of political involvement, hide and not be noticed, kiss the jackboots, go along to get along? Or will we show true political and personal mettle and act aggressively with collective and individual strength and resoluteness